the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to America's most listened to late night talk show, Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we're going to be bringing in Douglas Hagman to talk about reports that Abu Musab Zaqawri, he's the person in Iraq, and we just can't find, that he may have obtained some kind of nuclear device. Very important story. We'll talk with Douglas Hagman next hour about that. Here's some stories of the day, though. An Army sergeant has been convicted by a military jury of premeditated murder and attempted murder in a grenade and rifle attack, you might remember that, that killed two of his comrades and wounded 14 others in Kuwait during the opening days of the Iraqi war. 34-year-old Hassan Akbar now faces a possible death penalty, which the 15-member jury will consider at a hearing that begins on Monday. Prosecutors say that Akbar told investigators that he launched the attack because he was concerned U.S. troops would kill fellow Muslims in Iraq. They said he coolly carried out the attack to achieve maximum carnage on his comrades in the 101st Airborne Division. 11 people, including 6 Americans, were killed in a helicopter crash near Baghdad. It was apparently shot down. And what was even one of the most despicable things I have seen, these people that shot this helicopter down found one survivor. They videotaped him while they shot him to death, and then they sent it out to internet sites and Arabic television networks. The glaciers of the Antarctic Peninsula, they say, are in rapid retreat. A detailed study reported in Science magazine shows nearly 90% of the ice bodies streaming down from the mountains to the ocean are losing mass. But the authors, a joint team from the British Antarctic and U.S. Geological Surveys, say the big melt could have a number of complex causes. They say possibly it has to do with the oceans warming up as well. Whatever it is, it's going to be a big story for us in the not-too-distant future. You think you have it bad financially? Listen to this. A woman from Bangladesh, desperate for money after she was abandoned by her husband, has offered to sell one of her eyes. I desperately looked for a job to live and provide for my 2.5-year-old daughter, she says. She's 26 years old. I can't find any work, so I have decided to sell one of my eyes. What do I do with both eyes anyway, while my daughter will die for want of milk and food? Now, men in Bangladesh have been known to advertise their kidneys for sale to generate cash, but she is the first woman in the country to advertise her eye. She did not set a price in a newspaper advertisement she placed, but she said she hoped to get enough to set up a business as a street vendor or toy seller. Isn't that a sad story? In Chicago, someone emailed this, the death of a 43-year-old epidemiologist, a professor, Dr. Douglas Passaro. He is an expert. He's a microbiologist. He's dead. Cause of death awaits further study by the Cook County Medical Examiner. Most of the kits containing a killer flu bug that ended up in thousands of laboratories around the world, sparking fears of a pandemic, have been destroyed now, according to U.S. health officials. About 99% of the kits containing samples of what is called H2N2 flu virus, which they say killed between 1 and 4 million people in 1957, have been safely disposed of as a medical waste, they say. Health officials in the United States and 17 other nations have been scrambling to account for the proficiency kits, which were sent now to 3,700 laboratories and centers as part of routine testing of laboratories' abilities to detect strains. However, in a moment, our investigative reporter, NoMoreFakeNews.com, John Rappaport, he's got something else that he's uncovered. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
This hour of Coast to Coast AM is brought to you by United Healthcare. It just makes sense.
John Rappaport has worked as an investigative reporter for more than 20 years. He's the author of 5 books and has written on medical fraud, deep politics, health issues for newspapers, magazines in the United States and Europe, including CBS's Health Watch, Spin, Stern, LA Weekly. LA Weekly, as a matter of fact, placed John's name in nomination for a Pulitzer Prize for his interview with the president of a Salvador University where a military takeover had occurred. He's been following a lot of stories for us here on Coast to Coast. This one, of course, being the virus, the flu virus, that got mailed out to 3,700 labs. Now, John, every time I see the story, they've changed the amount of laboratories that they say they sent this to.
Yeah, that's right, George. In fact, now they seem to be adjusting the number of labs to the number of samples, finally, because before they were saying it was sent out to almost 5,000 labs and there were only 3,747 samples. So now they're reducing that to make it look like they know what they're talking about, but they don't.
A little too late, don't you think?
Yeah, quite a bit too late.
John, the CDC, of course, last week when we were following this story, admitted that it was not an accident, that it was sent out intentionally. Now, they didn't go out and say that they thought it was a criminal intent, but they did say it was sent out intentionally, that it had to have been. What have you uncovered lately?
Well, first of all, to clear up a little bit of confusion, all the labs that tested this virus passed their tests with flying colors, no doubt, because they were only required to determine whether the sample was so-called type A or type B. So they were never asked to look any further to discover what year it was and what strain and that kind of thing. And that's why none of the labs, until the one in Canada uncovered it, knew anything about it. So all this passed completely under the radar. One of the very interesting points that I've turned up here is that on April 13th, the head of the CDC, Dr. Gerberding, admitted that the Canadian lab that first discovered this a virus had been sent out, and this was around March 26th.
Okay, and this is a sample that was sent to the Canadian lab, right?
That's right,
okay.
For testing. They discovered this virus not in a test sample, but in a specimen sample from a human patient. In other words, despite all the rules about safe handling of viruses in the lab and so on, the 57 virus had somehow escaped from a proficiency testing sample into a patient, a human patient sample that was being treated by a doctor somewhere. I mean, talk about completely reckless handling. In order for that to happen, safety procedures had to be out the window completely. So this gives us a glimpse into what actually happens in labs as opposed to all the bland PR statements about how everything is completely safe. And that's a fantastically important thing. The other basic thing is that the CDC is now admitting that there are about 24 samples that were sent out in the United States that have not been destroyed, and they don't really know where they are. They don't know which labs have them. They're looking into it. They're investigating. And so who knows how many labs actually in the U.S. were shipped these samples and how many still have them and how many have not been destroyed. Now, there's one left, according to press reports and statements from the World Health Organization outside the country, and that's in Beirut, Lebanon, and that's been sitting in the airport there for it to be, get this, shipped out somewhere else for destruction. In other words, we're going to get more shipping.
No, wait a minute. We sent one of these strains to the Middle East?
Yeah, exactly. They were shipped to a number of countries, and exactly one of these was shipped to Lebanon, and it's sitting at the Beirut airport. It's been sitting there for at least a couple of weeks now, and the officials there are waiting for orders as to where to ship it now so that it can be destroyed. Whereas all that has to happen is the World Health Organization people fly in from, say, Geneva, someplace close, and they destroy it there by heating it. But they want to ship it again, which opens this whole thing up to yet more leakage and more contamination. So that's, you know, completely insane. And also the situation with the Canadian lab is very ominous because obviously this virus got loose in the lab and started migrating all over the place. And who knows if the Canadian lab has found all the 57 flu viruses that are moving around there.
John, what do these facilities look like, the facilities that are the keepers of these strains? I mean, can you, if you're a scientist and you were walking down the hallways, would they have, like, refrigerators that would say 57 flu strain, AIDS virus, anthrax, polio, all the way down the line? I mean, is that how they keep these things?
In general, yes, that is how they keep them. Now, they would have separate storage lockers for what they would consider to be the more dangerous germs, like anthrax would not be sitting side by side with flu. But basically, that's what you've got. You've got refrigerators, and you've got samples, and the samples are supposed to be labeled correctly. You know, the guts of this story that we've been covering here for the last couple of weeks is now breaking out in related aspects all over the place. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And on the same line as your question, for example, we've got an aerosol chamber that's manufactured in Wisconsin. It's got a hood on it. This is in labs in 9 states in the United States and 3 foreign countries. The National Institutes of Health has encouraged that this chamber be used because it's supposedly so safe. And what they do with this is they do animal experiments. They load up this chamber with all kinds of various germs, and they aerosol it to lab test animals to see what happens to these animals in these labs. Now, some of this research is biowarfare research, so we're talking about serious germs there. So we have a more or less a breaking story as of this month that one of these chambers in Seattle has leaks. 3 cases of TB infection in human workers there were diagnosed. And other reports are coming in that these chambers actually leak in other places. The state of Washington Attorney General investigation of the lab in Seattle discovered that the actual inventor of this particular chamber trained the people in Seattle and said, this chamber is absolutely safe. Never be a problem. And now it turns out that this thing is leaking all over the place. The same manufacturer has these chambers in 9 states of the U.S. and 3 foreign countries. So another story of the same kind. We've got exposure infections in a Boston University lab, rabbit fever, which is also called tularemia. Now, this is a specifically biowarfare germ that is being researched in various labs. And so there at the university, they had leaks and infections. And on top of that, the Centers for Disease Control refuses to say when the researchers at the lab in Boston started doing their work with it, how far back this thing goes. Naturally, people would want to know. And the key point here is that now these labs and these health agencies and the U.S. government are using so-called bioterror laws to shield the government from any public knowledge of how many of these leaks are actually occurring.
So they don't have to tell us.
They do not have to tell us.
Now, in this particular case, the 57 strain, why did they come public with this? Was it leaking out? Were we going to find out about it, so they had to say something?
Yeah, the story broke in Canada, so it was, a fait accompli. There was no way to cover it up. And then the word got out that this was a proficiency test sample, which means everybody knows, certainly in the medical world, that it went out to, several thousand labs, and so they had to admit to the story and then try to put the best PR spin on it possible. But also, as we discussed in an earlier show, this, to my mind, was at a higher level than the CDC, an intentional operation to create fear, and the people behind that definitely wanted it exposed in the press. They wanted this to come out. You know, this, as we discussed, you know, you said, how more insane can it get in the last time we talked? Well, check this out. As of March, the American Research Institute of Infectious Diseases in Maryland, a biowarfare institution that has labs and does this kind of thing, is now claiming that offensive bioweapons research is perfectly okay. Whereas before, I mean, there's treaties against this.
Right.
They're saying now, no problem. And even more, they go on in a release and describe something that happened in the 1950s called Operation White Coat. Very important. Thousands of Seventh-day Adventists were infected with various germs out of, you know, from the air that was part of biowarfare weapons research in the U.S. And now, 2005, this Army Research Institute is saying this is a good model for the kind of offensive bioweapons research that we want to do. I mean, this is like saying, we want to infect people in the United States with these weapons to check them out.
See if they work, right?
See if they work, and this is acceptable. So when people start talking about chemtrails, for example, there may be a tie-in to this very kind of specific thing that the Army Research Institute is now claiming is quite fine, quite okay, no problem. It's just part of offensive bioweapons research. I mean, this is just unbelievable.
Well, the more and more reports that we get of chemtrails and more stories I see like this one, John, you begin to connect dots. And because there's this incredible cover-up in terms of what are these chemtrails, what are they using them for, this is not natural. You begin to wonder, as you have just presented, what are they doing and why are they doing it?
Absolutely, completely. What I came across when I was writing my first book in 1986-87, AIDS, Inc., I started looking into what was happening in these biowarfare labs, and I compiled a kind of sketch of the history of human experimentation on people in America that had to do with biological and chemical weapons. And one of the things that became very clear to me is that the substances that they were using in some of these biowarfare labs, none of which had anything to do with HIV, were and could cause a symptom pattern in people that could easily be interpreted as AIDS. And there it was, all these labs leaking materials, crazy experiments going on, claims of perfect safety that were total lies. And this has been going on for 60, 70 years, unabated. And now the government is basically saying, we don't have to tell you, the public, what we're doing, where we're doing it, and if there are any accidents, if we don't want to, we don't have to tell
you. We're not going to tell you, and we're not culpable if there are.
Exactly. On top of that, we're not culpable. You notice in this flu scandal we've been discussing, nobody is really getting blamed. You don't see any suits being filed or criminal actions, and this isn't only the government.
You would think that this lab that sent it out, I guess they're doing it under contract, right?
Yes.
You would think that they would lose their contract for this gross negligence.
Absolutely. At the very least, there were four of these basic medical groups, like the American College of Pathologists was the main one, that sent out these flu virus samples. Now, nothing is happening to them. Nothing is happening to their supplier who actually did the mailing of the samples, Meridian Bioscience in Cincinnati, and absolutely nothing is happening to the company in Virginia, American Type Culture Collection, that actually made up the 1957 flu virus sample to begin with that started the whole thing. Zero is happening to them, and none of those organizations are even government. They're all nonprofits or private corporations. So you can imagine what would happen if you tried to sue the CDC. I mean, it would be laughed out of court.
You can't do it. John, I'm going to hold you for a half hour. I want to open up the phone lines because over the last couple of weeks that you've been on the program, people have been just, I was going to say, itching to talk with you, but I better not use that word. That may be another thing that they're releasing on all of us. So stay with us. John Rappaport, our guest, his website, nomorefakenews.com. We'll open up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to chat with him as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
The After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe now by calling toll-free 1-888-727-5505. Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, let me tell you something that you need to know about for you, because I'm told that the Coast to Coast listeners are one of the most supportive for this organization, Children International, that they have ever seen. They set a goal of 100 children for this campaign. It's a two-week campaign, and we are way past the halfway point already into this. So first of all, for me, thank you. What it is and what they're asking you to do is, if you can afford $18 a month to sponsor a child, mine is Maritza, a little five-year-old from Guatemala, whose family is very appreciative of this gesture. What you can do if you want to sponsor a child, you can call this toll-free number, which is 1-800-869-9863. That's 1-800-869-9863. They ask for a one-year commitment, but they'll only debit you $18 a month for that commitment. And in some cases, I think, and that may be voluntarily, by the way, you may just have to do it for a few months and decide if you want to continue it, which I hope you do. The other way, you can go to the coasttocoastam.com website, and on the left-hand side, you'll see a flashing yellow banner. Click that. That'll take you right to the website, and you can sponsor a child that way, too. So let's keep rolling. We are past the halfway mark, and we still have a week and a few days to go in the campaign. So that's great news. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you and John Rappaport. John, before we go to calls, let me ask you, because you did a lot of work with your book, AIDS, Inc., Scandal of the Century. I have always heard that this virus was made in a laboratory and that it was let loose on purpose. In your investigation, what happened?
What I discovered basically about 6 months into my research was that HIV was not the cause of AIDS, to put it bluntly. And it bowled me over completely because I had been using that as my basic assumption, then trying to figure out where it came from,
right,
because I knew the monkey theory was all wrong. And once I saw that, all bets were off. And I mean, I delved into that not just then, but for the last, 15 years or so, I've kept up with the story, and the evidence is even more convincing now. So what I decided in my book, and I still believe to be absolutely true, is that research in bioweapons labs and in chem weapons labs is one of the factors that has created this symptom pattern that people call AIDS. It's one of the factors. There are many. But that the virus itself was a complete and utter scientific hoax on that level, and was also very politically motivated as a way of controlling populations by floating that particular lie. And therefore, yes, bio warfare labs were definitely involved, but not directly as creating a germ which was deadly. Now, were they experimenting with something that they thought was HIV in labs and so on? I've seen some evidence that indicates that that might be possible, but the bottom line on it is that it's a complete dud, and there is even a good chance, I would say a 50-50 chance, that the virus as such does not even exist, but was something else was isolated besides a virus, and it was called a virus to begin with back in the early 80s. So that's kind of a very fast sketch on a long subject.
All right, let's go to the phones. First-time caller line, where are you calling from?
Los Angeles.
Well, you're right around the corner then.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you very much, Mr. Rappaport. I've listened to Coast to Coast quite a long time and always enjoy Mr. Rappaport.
Thank you.
My big question is, when I listen to a lot of the information that comes through, is what does one do to protect oneself? Where does one go if in the United States, where? If in the world, where? Which country? And what does one do to prepare for the pretty horrible things that are coming?
Well,
I'm a single woman, by the way, that lives. I'm a baby boomer. I live alone right now.
Okay. My, the advice that I take for myself, and the information that I've researched, is that people who keep their immune systems basically strong are in, way ahead of the game. I mean, way ahead of the game. Mm-hmm. As opposed to people who, on the other end of the scale, every time they have the slightest symptom, they get completely paranoid and they go to the doctor and they take drugs that end up suppressing their immune systems.
Right.
Of course, every person decides for themselves whether they see a doctor or not and when. But
no, I believe
it's important to understand that the medical system, the conventional medical system, is not in the business of strengthening the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that a person does on their own. They need to look into nutrients. They need to look into diet. They need to look into exercise. They need to look into if they really want to get deeply into this, are they living in areas that are just, rife with pollution all over the place?
Like Los Angeles?
Well, that would be an example, yes. But even in Los Angeles, you would go into certain areas where things would be much more hazardous than, near the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a mixed bag as well. Mm-hmm. But, that's the basic theme, is strengthening the immune response by those natural means. That's what I do, and that's what other people that I know do, and they tend to be much more successful at staying healthy regardless of all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to do that. But if one was to try to make the ultimate and could leave, where would you recommend they go?
You know, that's really a tough one. I don't know on the map, you know, where I would point to. If I were involved in something like that, I would probably want to live near the coast somewhere, some coast or another, where at least you get, you know, winds with somewhat fresh air and clean air out of the city, that sort of thing. But then you have to look at the specific area because, you know, people sometimes move to places and they say, gee, what's this lab right around the corner from me that I didn't know about, you know? So I know that's pretty general, but that's the best I can tell you.
John, on a 1 to 10, with 10 being the ultimate in confidence, where would you put the FDA?
Zero.
I knew you would say that.
Minus 57.
Yeah, you'd like to take it down underneath zero, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would, actually. You know, I've looked into the FDA for at least 15, 20 years now, followed fairly closely all that time. It isn't just the Vioxx. It isn't just the banner headlines when a drug is recalled and the company is losing money, which is one of the reasons they run these stories in the first place. But it's the ongoing history of that agency in certifying drugs as being safe when they're not, effective when they're not. It's just standard procedure. And on my site, I've hammered for the last several years over and over again that at a minimum, you're talking about 100,000 people in the U.S. every year, like clockwork, that die from the effects of correctly prescribed FDA-approved drugs. I mean, 100,000 people a year. You're talking about 2.1 million hospitalizations, roughly, from the same reason, and 22 million serious adverse reactions. I mean, that is chemical warfare. That is
really
chemical
is.
Warfare against the population. And if you want to look to the government to see how that gets through the government, you're looking squarely at the FDA.
West of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. John, thanks for taking my call. And it's always good to hear John talk about the topics he does. I was in Barstow last weekend, and I noticed chemtrails being sprayed up above the area where I was at. And looking, I tried to get my binoculars out. I tried to see what kind of planes, if there's any markings or anything on them. I couldn't see nothing. They were too high up. But I was looking at the way the patterns were being sprayed, and the wind was drifting in the direction of Las Vegas. Now, my question to John is this. If they're spraying chemicals, I think it's kind of like the primer before you put on the finished coat. What would happen, and how would the government that's doing this spraying, if they wanted to kill off a whole bunch of people, how are they going to contain the disease from the decaying bodies?
Well, you know, my understanding, and just by observation, is this is a debilitation operation. This is not an operation. I mean, you don't see, at least right now, you don't see people dying like flies all over the place in one location in huge numbers. This is gradualism, you know, boil the frog slowly by slowly increasing the temperature of the water. All the effects of what we've been talking about here tonight are weakening to the immune system if you just keep on doing it and doing it and doing it. It's a gradual effect. So that's the kind of operation that these people are engaged in and have been doing for a long time. It's hard to understand the mindset, I understand that, but when we were talking earlier about suddenly the Army Research Institute says, hey, we can carry out offensive bioweapons research and we can actually expose the public, and this is all very well and good and it's worth it in the current climate of terrorism and this and that and the other thing. Well, a lot of these people at the Pentagon actually believe this. I mean, they have a worldview in which anything is okay to do if the end product is, you know, saving the country from destruction. And you say, well, that's not logical. Of course it's not logical. It doesn't make any sense. And then if you go to a higher level than just these Pentagon people, I believe you then discover that, you know, the intentional aspect is very clear to those people.
And
very loose. They
the
want a weakened population.
And the callousness and the feeling of who cares at that top, at that level. They don't care, John.
No, absolutely not.
West of the Rockies. No, let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you tonight?
I am fine. Thank
it's
you.
It's great to talk to you. This is Gabrielle from Wisconsin. John, it is an insightful delight also to talk to you. Thank you for your wonderful contributions and all the work you do.
Thank you.
My question is, basically, I am one of 1.5 million people that have chronic fatigue syndrome in this country. There have been many papers that have been out and also a lot of cover-up with the CDC of diversion of $12.9 million of research funds about 5 years ago. And, of course, we don't know, and that's why I'm so happy to talk to you, whether you think this was maybe a lab-made type of biowarfare thing, because we had read papers that there was something that was out of Canada that could have been a possible linked to the Nixon administration way back when, that biowarfare could have been, this is only hypothetical, could have been created for, whether it's a vaccine that could have been controlled by a database with, say, somebody's name, Jane Smith, John Doe, in years to come. How would this event affect this person 5 years, 10 years after onset? I would really like to know your insight on this, and I know there's lots of people in the sound of my voice that are feeling what I feel tonight. Thank you so much, John. God bless you.
You're welcome. It's funny that you asked that question, because just today I came across an item in which it's very clear that the operation is now to try to claim that chronic fatigue is a psychiatric condition, and money is being diverted for, quote, psychiatric treatment, which of course means drugs and diagnoses of clinical depression and all this kind of thing, to move people over into that medical category and away from a consideration of anything physical. My take on it is simply this. It's what we've been talking about. If people's immune systems are potentially compromisable, and you then begin step by step, over and over and over again, exposure to these kinds of chemicals and biological entities, you're going to get a gradual debilitation. And when that happens to a great enough degree, the person's going to know it. They're going to feel it. Can't get up in the morning, can't get out of bed, don't want to do anything, feel tremendous lassitude, and so on. It seems to me that it's a cumulatively building situation. And therefore, again, I mean, my wife is a nutritionist and she deals with lots of people, and it's the matter of reversing this has to do with building up the immune system, basically. That's the bottom line. And I have seen people, whether they're patients of hers or in other situations, who have been able to reverse things and come back by beginning to really just look at those factors. What nutrients do I need? What should I be eating? Can I get organic food? Can I be doing some kind of gradual exercise to keep myself in some sort of better physical condition as I can? And, you know, on and on, just those very basic things, good water. And I've seen people come back. But when you're dealing with the kind of exposures that we're talking about here and people who are susceptible over a period of time, immune compromise is what we're talking about, then you've got a serious situation, and it's not getting better.
I know what I wanted to talk with you about too, John, because just a day or so ago, the CDC revised its figures on obese people who die.
Oh,
Did you know this story? It went from 340,000 deaths in the United States, where if you are obese, you have the number two death rate in this country. It's now moved to 7 because they revised their figures down to like 25,000. How do they make mistakes like this?
You know, at that level, most of the mistakes are made by PR that they, their own PR that they begin to buy, and the desire for funding. At that level, people have no idea how vicious the game is. You know, that's like the rat scurrying around in the cage is what you're looking at there. You've got the CDC with, you know, 650 different departments, who knows how many, or the National Institutes of Health, even much vaster. Each department is competing for federal money. And in order to do that, they have to play up the need and the terrible, ominous portent of what's going to happen. And they keep on doing this year after year after year, and they exaggerate in their studies. They do whatever it takes to get money. And then somebody comes along and says, well, let's just look at the studies here. Wow, that was a total screw-up, complete screw-up. How did this thing happen? Go to the PR people. You'll find out how it happens. Go to the department heads of the labs, you know, that are studying obesity, for example, and you'll see that they're in a complete scramble all the time for research money, and those people tend to say and do whatever it takes to get it.
What's on the website, nomorefakenews.com?
I'm working on this story that actually we're discussing tonight.
All right, good. We're ahead of the game here.
Yeah, all absolutely.
Right. Very good. John, keep in touch. You do yeoman's work, my friend.
Thank you, George. I really appreciate it.
John Rappaport. He doesn't let a story slip through, and we won't let it either with him around, I'll tell you. In a moment, a couple hours of Douglas Hagman. We're going to talk about the possibilities that there's Abu Musab Zaqawri. He's the guy who's joined hands now with Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. He's the Jordanian hiding around in Iraq, responsible for these beheadings and bombings. There's been some reports that he might have obtained a nuclear device. Unconfirmed, but Defense Department officials are concerned enough where they're sending this around in a classified report. We'll be back with Douglas Hagman in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.